Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:07 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is Friday, March 23rd, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. This week has been relatively steady right across the majority of markets. Most of Asia finished the week on a downward note. India was an exception. It was in positive territory. The Chinese market continues to pull back from the lower side of its 200-day moving average. It really does need to hold the majority of its advance since earlier this year if the demand story is really to be given credence for the medium term, and a sustained move above the MA would really indicate a return to medium-term demand dominance. This was also an interesting week in the sovereign bond markets. US Treasuries pulled back very sharply last week. Then they steadied, and the 30-year is now currently up to almost 138. Gilts have also steadied. The German Bund has rallied over the last few days. So have JGBs. A short-term oversold condition was evident earlier this week. The likelihood of a bounce had increased. We're now getting that bounce. What now remains to be seen is whether these government bond prices are going to encounter resistance at the lower side of those overhead trading ranges. If they do that, then a medium-term top will have been confirmed. We've had a lot of talk. I think people have been racing to get their comment in early that the secular 30-year bull market in US Treasuries is over. We are certainly not the biggest bulls in the world of US Treasuries, quite the opposite, I would say. But we do need to see confirming evidence that the supply side has returned to dominance beyond the short term. So these prices will have to encounter resistance in the region of the lower side of those overhead trading ranges to really start to indicate that we've got a medium-term top here and not just a period of short-term weakness. It's still very much in the interests of central banks to keep the price of these particularly long-dated bonds at elevated levels. They want to keep a lot of stimulus in the system, and that's one of the reasons that these markets have been so firm over the last few months, is because various central banks have been flooding the global markets with liquidity. This week, we saw that gold was a bit steadier. It has pulled back into the region of its 200-day moving average. It's closing out the week in the region of $1,660. That's pretty much where the 200-day MA is at present. It needs to demonstrate that it can improve from this level to really confirm that it's in the process of finding support. It has had quite a bit of technical deterioration. I think the same is true of silver, platinum, and palladium. They don't offer the most consistent chart patterns out there at present. It is very much for the bulls to prove in the short term. When we look at the medium term, silver had an accelerated peak up there, close to $50 last year. Now, I remember when I first joined Fuller Money back in 2003 and talking with David in 2003 and 2004, thinking that, you know, silver might well get back to its 1980 peak of around $40. And that was probably a logical area for it to get back to in the course of its secular bull market. Well, it did that last year, and it did it in impressive fashion. It hit a peak of over $50. So it's pulled back sharply. It's it's at a medium period of consolidation. We've seen that there have been lengthy periods of consolidation in the precious metal markets over the last decade. And this is certainly turning into one of those, particularly for gold. Gold has now been ranging for in excess of 6 months, and that's the longest range that it's had in the last 3 years. Provided it continues to find support at around the current area or between the current area and about $1,550, then there would be really no reason to question the secular bull market. If it were to start sustaining a move below those sorts of levels, then we would really need to start to reassess, because that would represent an additional loss of uptrend consistency. So it does remain for the bulls to prove in the precious metal markets. In the commodity markets generally, the continuous commodity index was weak again for the last few days. It encountered resistance in the region of its 200-day moving average in the last couple of weeks, and it's been deteriorating from that level. Whereas the precious metal markets finished out the week in a bit more positive territory, the commodity complex generally has been weaker and over the last few months. This week, it was a bit steadier. The sugar market, which was quite a bit stronger in the early part of the week, finished out the week on a softer note, but it looks like it is in a base formation phase. The natural gas market is down to $2.26, and that trend continues to deteriorate. There's no great evidence yet that it is in the process of finding support. The Arabica coffee market has deteriorated sharply in the last 3 months. It's really quite overextended relative to the 200-day moving average. It's at least lost downtrend momentum and could be in the process of building support for a reversion towards the mean. The grain and bean complex pulled back in the early part of the week but has steadied up in the last few days. Corn is currently in the region of 646 cents. Wheat in the region of 654, and soybeans, which has been leading on the upside. It posted a downward dynamic a couple of days ago, but it bounced back well yesterday, and it's up in here today at up 16 cents and continues to close in on that 1400 cents level. The US dollar was a bit firmer in the early part of the week and a little bit weaker into the close of this week. The euro is back in the region of $1.32. The pound is in the region of $1.58. This was a week in which the Japanese yen weakened to almost 84 yen. It strengthened sharply yesterday. It has a short-term oversold condition, particularly against the US dollar. There is some potential that the yen is going to strengthen somewhat in here to unwind that oversold condition. But since the Bank of Japan has adopted an inflation target, then they are more likely than not to attempt to hit the currency again if it starts to strengthen in any meaningful way. When we look at stock markets, we've had a rotational unwinding of short-term overbought conditions. That's encouraging, because one of the things that was very prevalent in the latter half of last year was the one-to-one correlation that we were seeing right across risk assets. They were all going up and going down at the same time. What we're now starting to see in some of these stock markets is that short-term overbought conditions are being unwound in some markets, not in others, that you're getting a little bit more variability in performance. That's encouraging, because it would suggest that some of these markets are beginning to trade on their own individual merits and their own fundamentals, rather than a lurch from one extreme to the other because of short-term fears and liquidity supply and liquidity crunches. The S&P is currently hovering in the region of 1400. This is in the region of the previous peak. It spent 4 weeks in just below the peak. It moved to a new high in the last week, and it's held on to the majority of the advance. It continues to be one of the leading markets globally. You can count on your hands the number of markets that have moved to a new high in the last year, and are a new one-year high in the last few months, to be more accurate. And the NASDAQ and the S&P are both on that list. There are a number of reasons for that outperformance. One is that the U.S. economy is beginning to recover, and the USA has been somewhat of a safe haven because of people's fears about the integrity of the Eurozone. But what they're buying is interesting because the USA is replete with autonomies. And we define autonomies as companies that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer, that have a globally dominant brand and dominate their respective niches, that have strong cash flows, and more often than not, have a solid record of paying out respectable dividends. The USA has a large number of those companies, so does the UK, so does Switzerland, so does Japan. And those are companies that are doing particularly well in the current environment. Their respective economies, their home economies, may not be setting the world alight in terms of their growth figures. But these are companies that have outgrown their domestic markets. They're truly globally oriented. And they represent the pillars of the growth of the global consumer. If we were to describe our current age, it would have to be the age of humanism. Because in the next 30 years, there are probably going to be more humans alive than at any time in the past, and probably again in the future. We're seeing an increasing number of countries starting to get their economic act together. They are progressively lifting an increasing number of their people out of poverty and into the middle classes. Standards of education are improving, and the availability of education for women is also improving. And if we look back at the history of Europe and the North America, Latin America or Asia, the availability of education for women brings down the birth rate. And that would suggest that the global population is going to peak in the next 30 or 40 years. So we're living in an age where the global population is continuing to rise. It's probably never going to rise at this rate again, ever. We're in an age where the per capita consumption of just about everything continues to increase. The companies that can produce and supply the growing consumer base with what they want, need, and increasingly can pay for, will continue to do remarkably well. Apple represents probably the totem of the autonomy sector. It's remarkable because it's become one of the biggest companies in the world through EPS growth rather than hype. It has some of the loyalest customers of any company. It's overbought in the short term. It's paused now in the region of $600. This has so far been an equal-sized reaction. If it starts to break down out of this range, then it will have posted not only a near-term peak, but a medium-term peak, and the prospect of a reversion towards the mean will have increased really quite considerably. But provided it holds within this range, then the medium-term upside can continue to be given the benefit of the doubt. There are some very important themes that are developing for the global economy. The first of those is in the energy complex, because while at present energy is expensive by most people's definition, that's unlikely to remain the case beyond the next 5 to 10 years. The supply of natural gas in the USA continues to increase. It's putting downward pressure on prices. Natural gas is competitive with coal now. And that's real economics. I posted a report last week which quoted some German figures where Germany has decided that it is going to phase out its coal generation plants and it's going to phase out its wind. So it's going to replace it with wind and phase out nuclear. What their estimates are is that by 2040, assuming technological innovation, that wind will be competitive with lignite today. Now, that is a 30-year gap where people will have to put up with considerably more expensive energy. That's not competitive. Not in an environment where wages are comparatively high and where energy is high. Now, the USA is in a very different scenario because it has the ability to phase in additional uses for natural gas over the medium term. That should help reduce the demand for oil, and oil supply is increasing. The USA could become energy independent within the next decade, and that will have very profound effects on its economy. All of the problems that are out there now about with deficits and unfunded liabilities become a much more easy problem to deal with in an environment where the country is energy independent. There will still have to be reforms, but those become much more manageable with a lot more money in the coffers. The USA will also become considerably more competitive because it will have low energy prices, particularly in an environment where Europe is hamstringing itself by adopting a high energy cost structure for production of electricity. China has got the world's largest reserves of shale gas. It is increasingly moving towards increasing its amount of nuclear energy. It's already one of the world's largest energy consumers. It's got a lot of work to do if it ever wants to become energy independent. But with the application of technology to previously inaccessible reserves, we're seeing an evolution in the energy complex, and it's going to have profound effects for economies globally. China is also going through an evolutionary process. In the last 2 years, it has moved from an infrastructure and manufacturing focus, and a capital investment focus, to attempting to get the most productivity it can out of its billion-plus population. There was an IMF report in January 2010, which highlighted the fact that China now gets more benefit from an investment in its people than it does from an investment in infrastructure. We're starting to see changes in policy. The latest 5-year plan is focusing on developing the interior and developing consumer demand for products, and in moving up the value chain in terms of manufacturing. Per capita consumption of all commodities remains on an upward track, but the pace of demand growth for Chinese demand growth in commodities is likely to trail off over the next decade. That represents a challenge for commodity suppliers, but perhaps not as great a challenge as many would perceive, because if China is in a process of evolving into a consumer-led economy and moving up the value chain in terms of manufacturing, India is doing the opposite. India has long relied on its internal market to shield it from the influences of an external market. It's relied on its large number of entrepreneurs to build globally competitive companies and to attract foreign investment. But it's lagged badly on infrastructure. So whereas China has come to a position where it's getting more benefit now from investing in its people than infrastructure, India is at the same juncture the other way around. India would now get more benefit from investing in infrastructure than depending on the capacity of its economy to produce entrepreneurs. It needs to help support its human capital with infrastructure. It is in the process of beginning to do that. It's spending over $100 billion on infrastructure projects and on its attempts to corner supply chains for the various commodities it's going to need to fuel its economic development. Indonesia, which is a commodity exporter and has a very large population in its own right, is also embarking on a large infrastructure development project, over $100 billion. So, while Chinese infrastructure development is beginning to peak, it's beginning to pick up in a number of other large population centers that require infrastructure if they're going to capitalize on the migration of manufacturing capacity away from China, because the cost of labor has increased in China to a point where manufacturers are either moving well inland in China or they're moving abroad. And some of the countries that have done best from that migration are Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, Cambodia, and indeed India. We're also starting to see that some of the countries in East Africa are beginning to attract textile manufacture. Textile manufacture has long been the very first industry to help support economic growth. It speaks well of that for those respective economies that they are beginning to move up the ladder in terms of industrialization. Certainly in my own experience from going to various wholesale markets in China, the number of Africans that are there purchasing goods is really quite surprising. And it speaks of a growing consuming class in Africa. That would suggest that whereas we're seeing today the industrialization of large parts of Asia, that the industrialization of Africa is a theme that is beginning to get started and is likely to continue to pick up pace over the coming decades. The US Treasury market has been rallying for the last 30 years. It started out being treasuries were an excellent investment over the entire period. If you look at the Merrill Lynch 10-year plus total return index, which you'll find in the chart library, it represents one of the most consistent chart patterns you're going to see anywhere. And it's a 28-year bull market. Now, that started out because of the Great Moderation, where inflationary pressures continued to deteriorate. You had disinflation for a prolonged period of time. But that's not what you have right now. In the last decade, you've had repeated efforts by the Federal Reserve to support the US economy, which has been in a difficult period. The velocity of money has been trending downwards for the better part of a decade, and the Federal Reserve has been increasing the supply of money persistently to foster economic growth. Every major bull market, regardless of asset class, ends with an explosion of supply. In the case of the sovereign bond markets, what we're seeing and what we've seen over the last 3 and 4 years has been an increasing number of governments racing out to borrow as much as they possibly can at such remarkably low interest rates. That's not simply that's not just true of the USA and Europe, which have been plagued by massive debt problems and where governments have felt required to step in and socialize a large amount of private debt. But you've had companies such as Burlington Santa Fe issuing 100-year bonds. Mexico issued a 100-year bond in the last few years. You're seeing that a large number of companies are issuing debt because as even a more favorable way of accessing capital than the equity markets, because interest rates are at such low levels. So the supply has increased considerably. When someone needs to go out and borrow progressively more money, we do have to ask the question whether they become a reliable person to lend money to. The paradox of the debt markets is that the most liquid debt is from the issuers who have issued the most debt. But do we really need to be lending them the same amount of money that they require? When we look at what's happened in the debt markets over the last few years, governments have been supporting the market artificially, and they've been pushing yields to progressively lower levels. Investors have been more than happy to follow that in a momentum move and have been establishing overweight positions in treasuries and various other sovereign bonds that they deem to be safe havens. They were doing that, or at least they were justifying those actions, because they were saying that the most likely outcome for a number of economies was a deflationary scenario. What we're now beginning to see is that some of those very deflationary, very bearish forecasts are being scaled back, and the global economy remains on a growth trajectory. If you strip out the malaise and the worry and the volatility that we've had in the last 3 years, and you simply look at a global economy that is on a growth footing, then government bond yields at 2.25% are not appetizing. So we've had a breakdown in prices for government bond for US treasuries. We've had the yield push upwards. You had a little bit of oversold condition develop in some of those bond futures. If they do start to encounter resistance in the lower side of their ranges, then it will indicate that some money is beginning to move out of these safe haven assets and into potentially the stock markets, where there is still a great deal of value. If some of the macro themes fall into place as we think they're going to, that energy prices do start to come downwards in the next decade, and Wall Street completes its secular process of valuation contraction, then there isn't going to be a great deal of need to own some of these bonds at such very low levels. Then the prospect of the yield starting to rise becomes very realistic indeed. We have to remember that interest rates are at remarkably low levels, not just in the USA, but also in Europe and the UK and Japan, and that they are going to go up at some point, particularly if we start to see that growth begins to pick up once more, or that the USA begins to reindustrialize. So this is a period of time which is pregnant with possibilities, both on a long-term bullish cycle, but also for in the US Treasury markets, where there is the real possibility that a 30-year bull market in prices and a bear market in yields could well be ending. And there are going to be a number of ways in which to play that. I suspect that probably the best way to benefit from rising yields is to play it via high-yielding equities that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. They are probably some of the better companies the better investments that will hold their value in an environment where yield turns to a premium. There are a number of ETFs offering exposure to the treasury markets. Anything that is leveraged or that invests in futures needs to be actively managed, because there are interest rate costs, management costs, and roll costs that need to be factored into one's strategy. That means that ETFs that hold futures are for traders. They're not for investors. And if an investor is active in those, then they need to be monitored closely. If one takes the avenue for quality equities that have a respectable payout and a good record of increasing their dividends, then they probably require less monitoring than you would with something that is leveraged or that holds futures. So we remain in this long-term theme, the greatest urbanization in history, and we're in a multipolar world. There is a way of people talk about that the 18th century was the UK century, and the 1900s were the USA century, and that the 21st century is going to be that of China. I don't personally believe that's the correct way to think about the development of markets. We're in a multipolar world, and that means that there are going to be an increasing number of large economies that are going to have an increasing amount of trade between each other, so that it will not be correct to say that any one is the hegemon, but more that there are competing centers of influence. Everything points towards that conclusion if we set aside the idealism of one country being dominant for the next century. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the evening, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.